In effect, talking about conflicts that arise in the workplace is very, very difficult to talk about in a general level, because obviously every particular profession that somebody has raises a whole series of separate halachic questions. The story is told, I believe it's a true story, that at some point in his career, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter decided that he didn't want to have the rachrayas of teaching Torah and giving mutter, so he thought he would become a stockbroker. And after 6 months, he left that profession because he said it's much more difficult halakhically to be a stockbroker than it is to be involved in rabbanus and other things. He says the ethical and the halakhic questions were so intense that he felt he did not have the halakhic knowledge to be able to make the proper judgment. I suppose that there are really three areas that I want to address, at least in very, very broad outline. One might be regarded as some of the technical halachic issues in the realm of those aspects of halacha that are bein adam l'makom. I'm not going to talk a lot about that. There are issues of Shabbos, there are issues of kashrus. Baruch Hashem, though, because of both federal and state law and employer accommodation, the old issues, such as, if you have to take off on Shabbos, you have to find a new job on Monday, those types of issues do still exist, and there's still litigation and the like, but they're much less prevalent than they used to be. In other words, the issue of a person not being able to be a Shomer Shabbat in their employment is fortunately not as much of a problem. It is a problem, but not as much of a problem as it once was. Keeping kosher, well, Baruch Hashem, you are blessed to be New York, New Jersey area, in which you can even go to a fancy restaurant and take clients, and it's not as much of a problem as perhaps we have where I live and certainly in other outlying areas. It's interesting that for many years, when people talked about the various halachos regarding the interaction of men and women in the workplace, laws concerning negiah in terms of touching, laws even concerning yichud, about men and women not being alone in a room unless the door is open, We often didn't want to talk about that because it was thought to be something that the outside world wouldn't understand. You know, yichud, negiah, what type of throwback to primitive culture is that? And yet, all I could say is, without reiterating all that has been in the news in the past few months, I think this just confirms the eternal wisdom of the Torah in terms of the need for restraint, the need for boundaries, the need to have literally an open door policy, as it were, in this relationship, in order to prevent accusation, maris ayin, the various forms of immorality that can exist. So it's almost as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends us a siman every once in a while to remind us of the eternal validity of the Torah's truths. Again, those particular issues of Bein Adam, Lamakom, and the issues regarding Yichud, Negiah, Tznias, these are certainly common in all workplace environments, and these are issues that we always have to be cognizant of. The second major issue I'm going to address in much more detail are the various inyanim that pertain to interpersonal rights and responsibilities in the workplace, and particularly issues such as honesty, genevas das, and the like. And, you know, unfortunately, we sometimes do have the dichotomy. You sometimes hear, I've addressed this issue to other audiences, to non-religious audiences, talk about Jewish business ethics, and they might say some snide remarks, such as saying, that's an oxymoron, or they might say that must be the shortest book ever written, perhaps next to great Jewish football heroes, you know, Jewish business ethics. And people often raise the accusation, why are Orthodox Jews not honest in their business? Tremendous problem. I would suggest there are two fundamental answers that one can give. One answer might be, well, it's an unfair accusation to say that Orthodox Jews are disproportionately dishonest in business, and any group of people, some people are not living up to the moral norms. No, that might be a teretz, but as the Gemara calls it, that is called being doche bekash, knocking somebody away with a straw. If the most we could say is we're no worse than anybody else, and maybe even somewhat better, that's simply not good enough. The second, more basic answer, and this is, I think, something that we really have to have a consciousness of, is to dispute the premise of the question. I would submit that a person who is not meticulously honest in their business dealings cannot be defined as an Orthodox Jew, no matter whether what standard of kashrus or Shabbos or glatt kosher is being observed, simply because if being an Orthodox Jew or a Torah Jew, which might be a better term, a Torah observant Jew, refers to somebody that tries to the best of their ability, because none of us are perfect and all of us have our faults, but if one tries to the best of their ability to submit to the Ribono Shel Olam's Torah, then the same Torah that says, Lo Sevashel Gedi B'chalei Dimo, not cooking Basar B'chala, also talks about not stealing, not deceiving, not engaging in behavior. And therefore, I cannot accept the premise of the question, why are Orthodox Jews not honest in business? My answer is, there's no such creature. Because if one is not honest in their business dealings, then one, by definition, is not living the life of Halacha. One of the most unfortunate situations in our society, in our religious life today, is the fragmentation that we have between our personal family lives and sometimes our professional and business lives. It's almost as if we're two different people, meaning in our personal lives, we try to live in accordance with halakha, but what we do in Wall Street or the office or the business or the store is sometimes to lower ourselves to the ethics of the marketplace. If there'd be somebody from Mars observing us, would that someone from Mars actually know that this is a Torah observant Jew? And this is something that all of us have to be very, very conscious of, and that is wholly apart from the issue of Chilul Hashem, desecration of God's name that occurs when those who are allegedly observant of the Torah do not live up to the requirements of the Torah in the area of modesty, honesty rather, and fairness and truth in the marketplace. Again, this is the second topic that I will discuss, again in somewhat more detail. The third topic I'm going to address is somewhat related, and that is the conflicts that we face, not so much in tangible halachic matters, in other words, the halachic restrictions that we have, but more important, how professional and business life can undermine our fundamental spiritual values. Meaning to say, even if somebody keeps all of the halachas in the workplace, there are certain tensions in professional and business life that undermine or act against the type of personality that it seems that HaKadosh Baruch Hu envisions for a Torah Jew. Sometimes the qualities of compassion, kindness, tolerance get eroded when you have an atmosphere of competitiveness, cutthroat competition, and the like. So we have, once again, the technical halachic issues in the realm of Ben Adam, Lamakam, issues like Shabbos, Kashrus, and the like. We have the halachic issues regarding honesty in the business area, and then we have the issue of spiritual attitudes and how they can coexist in a successful business environment. Now, as I indicated initially, each profession has its very, very unique halachic issues. Just to give you a short catalog, I just on the train, I was just thinking of various professions. Law, which is the one that perhaps I'm the most familiar with. We have all sorts of issues such as the use of the legal system to inform on Jews. Let's assume you're an auditor or an IRS inspector or the like. We know that one of the most hated figures in the Jewish tradition is the Moser, the one who informs on his fellow Jew to the Gentile authority. And the question therefore always becomes, can a Jew be a participant in a criminal justice system, either in the investigative function, the reporting function, the prosecutorial function, the judicial function? After all, if it involves sentencing fellow Jews, or even as a juror, to imprisonment or fine, does that run afoul of the concept of Mesirah? Again, even a question like that would more than justify an entire lecture, but I will just note this. You sometimes see that the concept of Mesirah is invoked as an excuse, not even to report issues such as child abuse or sexual abuse. And it is very, very important to know that many poskim have said that if the crime or if the conduct which a person is accused of is something that is wrong under the law of the Torah, in other words, it is wrong, stealing or the like, and the punishment is considered to be legitimately within the scope of the seventh commandment of Noah, it's a legitimate exercise of the Noahide authority to maintain a stable society, which means that the punishment does not have to be the same punishment as the Torah. For example, the Torah does not mandate imprisonment for theft, but under the exercise of Noahide authority, that is legitimate, then it is proper, at least permitted and perhaps even laudatory, for a Jew to participate in the Noahide imperative of eradicating evil. And there's no question that when you're dealing with protecting innocent people like children, not only is there no prohibition of Mesira, but there would even be a mitzvah of Pikuach Nefesh, protecting victims, Ubiyar Taharon Mikirbecha, of invoking that process, particularly when there are no Jewish institutions that are capable of appropriate intervention. That's just one example of a particular issue. Another example is that in commercial contracts, it is very common for there to be a choice of law clause. A choice of law clause is a simple clause that says, this contract shall be governed by the laws of the state of New Jersey, or the laws of the state of New York. Or contracts contain all sorts of clauses that are inconsistent with the fourth portion of the Shulchan Aruch, Choshei Mishpat, where parties agree that the details of a transaction shall be governed by secular law. Our Jews, in particular, two Jews are involved. The Jew and the Goy can do what they want, basically. But are two Jews allowed to preempt Choshei Mishpat and apply secular law? Again, I'm going to be very staccato here. In many cases, they can, because halacha itself recognizes the abilities of the parties to stipulate in monetary matters to provide a different rule. This is what the Gemara calls governorship of mammon. In matters concerning money, property, financial liability, you could be masna, you could make a contrary stipulation to the law of the Torah, because it is recognized that in many types of monetary matters, the parties have a will through mechila, through waiver, and the like, to preempt. And yet, we have a tshuva from the Rashba that indicates something that people are often not aware of, that although on an issue-by-issue basis it is possible to stipulate contrary to the law of Choshei Mishpat, but it is improper to have wholesale clauses that say this shall be governed totally by secular law, because that is treated as a bizayon, a degradation of the Torah. Similarly, we have things that are called choice of forum clauses. A choice of forum clause may indicate which court shall hear the matter, or you may have an arbitration clause that indicates that a matter should be decided through arbitration. Here too, Jews should be aware of the fact that there's an iser d'oraisa for one Jew to take another Jew to a secular court to adjudicate their controversies. This is generally called the iser of arkaos shel nachrim. Now, Rashi makes the point in Chumash that even if the substance of law that is going to be applied by a secular tribunal is the same as the Torah would impose, and even if under principles like Dina de Malchus Adina, which legitimates secular law in many cases, the Beis Din themselves would be imposing secular law. Sometimes the Beis Din needs to impose secular law. It is prohibited as a general matter to go to secular courts. One should resolve issues within the framework of a Beis Din when a Beis Din is available. Now, granted, there are many, many ramifications to this. For example, if a defendant refuses to respond to the summons of a Beis Din, a hasmana three times, one may be given permission to go to secular court. In many types of tort litigation, the real party that is being sued is not the other Jew, it might be the insurance company. The insurance company is generally a non-Jewish institution. So even though the nominal defendant might be Jewish, you can sometimes pierce that and look at the defendant in substance. Moreover, there are circumstances in which a hasmana does not even have to be issued because it is facially apparent that the person may be so removed from Judaism that they would not respond to the summons of the Beis Din. But one must at least be aware of the iser of our ka'os, shel nachrim, and this is considered to be a chilul Hashem. Now, in this connection, though, there's a fascinating tshuva from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, which is a good thing for lawyers to know. And that is, Rabbi Akiva Eiger suggests that an arbitration clause, even if the arbitrators are a secular body, such as an arbitration panel chosen by the American Association of Arbitration or the like, suggests that that would not be a violation of the ISSA of Arcos, because the ISSA of Arcos is triggered only when you are referring a matter to the formal and legally recognized secular authority, and not when you're submitting it to a private, non-governmental body for decision-making. So according to Rebbe Kivego, it's actually referring to the medieval guild system, where disputes between merchants were to be resolved by local guilds, and they would not apply either Torah law or even secular law. They would simply apply what was considered to be equitable and matters of common sense and shiko hadas, and Rebbe Kivego argues that that is not a violation of our coast. But once again, one needs to be aware of these issues. And of course, the whole question, if I'm an attorney and my Jewish client wants to sue some other Jewish person in violation of our code, am I allowed to represent him in that case, or do I have to say no? And that gets us into the whole issue of what might be called accessory liability, meaning to say, granted, the transgressor of the primary issuer of our code is the plaintiff that is suing the defendant. The attorney is not directly transgressing the iser, because the Shulchan Aruch defines the iser, asur lehitzdayeh, it is forbidden to have your controversy adjudicated, but nevertheless, the attorney, by causing the lawsuit to be filed and continued, might be transgressing with me'iver lo siteh mikshol, putting a stumbling block in front of a blind person. Now, a technical litmei either the oraisa there probably is not, because the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah that litmei either lo sitei mikshol is only transgressed when without me the sin would not be able to be accomplished. Since there are plenty of lawyers in town, so even if I decline, the person can bring his lawsuit anyway, so a litmei either the oraisa there would not be, but there would still be a category which is midrabanan, that Chazal called Misayel Idvar Aveira. You're assisting somebody doing an Aveira, even if they could have done it without you, but if you're the one that is facilitating and assisting, there's a problem with Misayel. So this is a very, very short list of some issues that arise in legal practice. Another example is confidentiality. Client comes to you and says, you know, I had set fire to that building to collect the insurance, some insurance fraud. Now, if you are familiar, at least with the ABA's rules regarding confidentiality, which have not been adopted in every state, so I honestly cannot speak for what is the standard in New York or New Jersey, but at least under the ABA's model rules of professional conduct, confidentiality is so inviolate that unless the client informs you that they are about to either kill somebody or inflict grievous bodily injury, the confidence must be respected. So if a client were to tell you not only that I burnt the building, if a client were to tell you I am going to burn the building, that it was not just a past crime, but even an intent to commit a future crime, unless it involves imminent bodily harm or death, the ABA says there's a professional duty to maintain confidentiality. Now, it's interesting that in halakha there is no concept per se called confidentiality. In other words, halakha does not create a special subset of rules that doctors owe patients or lawyers owe clients. Rather, it is subsumed under the general principle of lashon hara. You're normally not supposed to reveal derogatory information about people. However, and therefore one must respect the confidences that clients repose in a professional simply because the disclosure of confidential information would generally involve lashon hara. However, all of us know, and I'll elaborate on this a little later on, that lashon hara is not only permitted, but even required when it is necessary to protect third parties who would otherwise be adversely affected, such as the area of shiduchim, the area of business partnerships, etc. So it's very, very clear that under halacha, both doctors and lawyers will have duties to disclose information to third parties, whereby under Jewish law, that disclosure would be, I'm sorry, under secular law, that disclosure would be prohibited, even though under halacha it would be required. Under those circumstances, as the Gemara tells us, divrei harav, divrei ha-talmid, divrei mishomen, in other words, secular law says one thing, halacha says something else, generally speaking, one would be obligated to comply with halacha, even perhaps at the risk of professional endangerment and the like. So these are issues that one has to think of. And again, there are many, many other issues in the profession of law, such as how do you write a halachic will, for example, if the laws of Yerusha are one way. How do you get involved in interest-bearing transactions between Jews? All of this is the attorney as facilitator. We go to medicine. We have all sorts of issues, such as living wills, the duty to treat terminally ill. As you know, the present law in the United States, particularly after the Supreme Court's ruling in the Cruzan case, is that there is a constitutional right to have virtually any type of medical treatment withdrawn or discontinued, even if the patient is not terminally ill, including feeding tubes and the like, because that is a penumbra, as it were, of the constitutional right of privacy, and the right to life under the 14th Amendment also includes the right to direct that medical treatment not be performed. Well, again, every single thing here is a separate talk, but suffice it to say that halacha sometimes requires that medical treatment be provided. Not always, but sometimes one does not have an unqualified right. That, once again, leaves the doctor in a very, very difficult quandary. The doctor can say, take me off the case. All right. But in reality, that's a cop-out. The doctor resigns from the case. The patient is going to be disconnected. But what can the doctor do? The doctor connects him. The doctor is open to malpractice. The doctor is open to civil liability, disciplinary proceedings, and perhaps, in an extreme case, even loss of license. Again, these are difficult dilemmas that healthcare professionals face. Journalism. I guess I can give something negative for everybody. Journalism, obviously, the strong prohibitions against Lashon Hara, which are the bread and butter of all journalism. In fact, I noticed a very fine and strongly worded essay by your esteemed Rev. I guess it was in the Shul newsletter, but Gary Rosenblatt sent it to me, in which he made this exact point that it's essentially impossible, almost, to either be a kosher journalist, in many cases, or even to be a kosher reader of journalism, because one is so involved in Lashon Hara, character assassination, and embarrassment. So the truth of the matter is, there is no profession that is safe. There is no profession that is immune. There is issue after issue after issue after issue. And of course, we have to recognize that the role of a Rav and the role of a spiritual advisor is not simply to tell you what happens if a milchik spoon falls into a fleshik sink. But indeed, in matters of money, in matters of parnasa, in matters of professional ethics, one needs to either become a posek, and Yirtzeh Hashem, as Moshe Rabbeinu said about Eldor Umeidad, Mi Yitain V'haya Kolam Nevi'im, Halavai, all of us can be zocha to become poskim. By all means, I encourage all of you to try that. But if one cannot become a posek, one at least needs to have a posek, somebody that they consult, somebody who understands the nuances of the business, because it is true that, to use an irreverent expression, in the areas of psak halacha, as is true for computers and other things, it is garbage in, garbage out, meaning to say, the posek that does not have a clear grasp of either the technical issues or the scientific issues or whatever it is, will be unable to give an informed judgment on it. But there needs to be a very close collaboration between the professional and the posek in order that an informed judgment can be made how to balance all of these various factors, because in every single profession there's going to be a tremendous amount of difficulties. I should also mention advertising, Madison Avenue, an industry that to some degree is based on convincing people that they need things that they may not really need. And besides the issues of sheker involved, there is a prohibition, lifnei iver lo sitein mikshol, which in front of a blind person, don't place a stumbling block. And one of the interpretations of Chazal is, don't give people advice to do things that are not beneficial to them. And a lot of advertising is premised on exactly that particular principle. So I guess if my plea is anything, obviously I'm bringing out a lot of questions and not answering almost anything, but my point is that each of these issues can have very extensive treatment in terms of makoros and understanding, and I guess it just proves the error of the maybe apocryphal story about a rabbi that once asked his congregant, why is it that you come to me about kashrus questions, but you never come to me about business questions. And the person is supposed to have responded, Rabbi, I don't tell you how to run your business. I don't expect you to tell me how to run mine. And I think this kind of just indicates on a superficial level the error of that type of response. The Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos that when a person dies, we are asked 6 questions by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem is very generous to us. He gives us the final exam in advance. We are told ahead of time the 6 questions we're going to be asked. And the very first question that he asks us is, Nasasa v'nasata v'yamuna. Did you conduct your business activities with Amuna? Now, interestingly enough, there are 2 translations for that phrase. One is, did you conduct your business affairs with honesty and integrity? That is one idea of Amuna. And the other interpretation is, did you conduct your business with faith in God, that God is the source of your panasa? So Amuna in that passage either refers to the honesty and integrity of how you conducted your profession, or it refers to your faith in God. But obviously, you see, the 2 are going to be related. Because if one truly believes that their parnassa comes from God, then they have to believe that they're not going to gain anything in the long run by violating God's will. There may be some short-term gains, which Rav Schwab used to say, mamon that is gained by sheker, it will never have a simon bracha, will never have a real blessing. Maybe, you know, it won't happen in your lifetime, yes, but it'll be the children, the grandchildren. Eventually, there will be no bracha that comes from that which is gained in contravention of the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is only the second question, Kavata Itim LaTorah, did you set aside regular times for the Torah? So the primacy of business ethics can be seen that is the very first question that HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks us. We also know that in the Torah, there is no dichotomy, as it were, between the ritualistic laws and the laws of Bein Adam LaChavero. In fact, if you open up any area of the Torah in which there are a lot of mitzvot that come together, whether it be Parshas Mishpatim or Parshas Kedoshim, right next to Lo Tavashal Gadi B'chalei Vimo is going to be stuff about not cheating. In other words, it's all the same. It is only the modern sensibility that kind of divides it between ritual law and civil law, etc. As far as the Torah is concerned, it is exactly all the same. Now, we say in Kriya Shema, V'ahavta eit Hashem Elokecha, you should love God b'chol levavcha, with all of your heart, b'chol nafshecha, with all of your soul, b'chol modecha, with all of your might. Rashi brings from the Gemara that one of the explanations of all of your might is to serve God with all of your money. And then Rashi raises the question, if the Torah says b'chol nafshecha, you have to be willing to give up even your life for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, kal v'chomer, how much more so? The person would have to give up all of their money. So what's the chiddush? Why does the Torah have to say you have to be willing to give up all of your money if the Torah already says you have to be willing to give up your life? So Rashi says, not necessarily. Some people, their money is worth more to them than their life. Of course, it's a fact. You're listening to the very famous Jack Benny radio show where the mugger comes to Benny and says, your money or your life, and then there's a 30-second pause. And Jack Benny says, let me think about it, you know. So indeed, Yesvacha Adam, Shemamon al Chazav al Mikufa. But how would that be understood? So one of the explanations is very simple. To give one's life for Kiddush Hashem is a tremendous, tremendous mitzvah and opportunity. Rabbi Akiva said all of his life, he yearned to be able to give his life for God. But when all is said and done, it's a momentary thing. It's a sublime, supreme sacrifice, but it's done in a moment. To live a life of integrity is a day-by-day protracted struggle. Every morning, every minute, one has to make new choices, moral choices, and one is surrounded in a world where other people are not necessarily playing by those rules. And it seems that they can get ahead while we have to make certain sacrifices. Yes, on some psychological level, it is sometimes easier to make a supreme sacrifice that's gone in a moment than to go with a day-by-day-by-day-by-day struggle of earning a living. And in that sense, b'chol ma'odecha is regarded on some level as even greater than b'chol nafshecha. Because one thing is a single act, and the other is a continuous struggle. And in fact, the Shem Yishmo, one of the great Hasidic Rebbe's, actually interprets this was the story of Balak. We're going to read in Sefer Gamidbor later on in the year that Balak was afraid of the Jewish people, and he hired the professional sorcerer Bilam to curse them. Now the question that's raised is, what is Balak afraid of? After all, the Chumash already said, Hashem told Moshe that the Jewish people are not allowed to wage war against Moab, because Moab comes from Lot, and that territory was supposed to be inviolate. What is Balak afraid of? All right, so the simple explanation is, Balak does not know that Hashem told Moshe they cannot wage war against Moab. But the Shem Yishuv offers the following explanation. The thing that Balak was afraid of is not that the Jews would take his territory. That he knew would not happen. He didn't want the Jews to enter the land of Israel. That is what he's afraid of. Why was he afraid of that? Because let's compare the existence of the Jews in the desert with their existence once they reach Eretz Israel. In the desert, they live a hermetically sealed existence. They have the man coming from heaven. They have a traveling well of water. They're surrounded by clouds of glory. Religion did not have to confront the daily and sordid demands of everyday life. So Boa is perfectly happy to have a Klal Yisrael remain in the desert. Because as long as they live in that hermetically sealed cocoon, they have no message to real people who are doing real things, who are struggling with the day-to-day in trying to build a just society. And therefore, Boa could look at the Jewish people and say, they're special, they're unique, they have no message, they have no relevance. But once the Jewish people come to Eretz Israel, life is going to drastically change. There's not going to be any man. There's not going to be any well. There's not going to be any clouds of glory. They're going to have to dig ditches and build societies and have doctors and even lawyers and accountants and chayalim and people who are going to die defending the country. And at that point, they're going to demonstrate to the world, at least in the idealistic sense, that it is possible to live a life of holiness, not only when you separate from the world, but it's possible to live a life of holiness in the world itself. Balak didn't want that to happen, because that would be a reproach, that would be a muster to the immorality that Balak and the Moabite culture stood for. And indeed, when we talk about business ethics is the great arena in which we demonstrate that our holiness in life exists not only when we separate and disengage from what is out there in our shuls and our yeshivas and our kollelim, but even when we are engaged in the mud, we can still live a life of nobility and a life of kedusha and a life of commitment to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But you see now what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter means, how hard that is. It's easy to be clean when you're in a clean environment. But how do you remain clean when you're in the mud of so much that is out there? Well, the Gemara in Erechim tells us, in terms of the marketplace, a minority of people sin sexually. Perhaps that's still true today. Most people sin in matters of theft. And all people sin in matters of lashon hara, derogatory speech, even if it's true. And if you think about the particular averot that occur in the marketplace, we really have all three. A minority sins sexually. We obviously have the sexual harassment issues, which are addressed largely by the concepts of yichud, negiah, smiyas, all of these requirements which we now, as I said earlier, we see how wise and how important those values are. Theft, a majority of people sin in theft. Well, again, let me emphasize what theft means in halacha, that the meaning of theft in halacha does not simply mean breaking a window and robbing a bank. Most people do not rob banks, but remember fundamentally that the notion of theft includes misrepresentation, which is called genevas das. It includes borrowing things without permission. Shoel shalomi das is considered to be a gazlan. So, for example, if one uses office supplies for personal use, That is considered to be a form of theft. If one makes long distance calls or even local calls on company time, or takes an unusual number of coffee breaks or the like, all of that is considered to be a form of theft. That is gezel. In fact, we know in halacha that even stealing somebody's sleep is considered to be gezel. That's called gezel shina. If you play your record player too loud, and the Chofetz Chaim used to say that gezel shina is even worse than stealing money, because sleep is very difficult to make up. Money you can return, lost sleep, as all of us know, is very difficult to obtain. So in that sense, the achrayas of not getting involved in any form of theft, deception, misrepresentation, use of business supplies for personal use, wasting of time. Of course, again, this is the issue of playing solitaire on one's computer at work. Now I understand some employers are able to monitor that. Once again, I'm not suggesting that anybody that takes a coffee break is transgressing gezel, but though depending on whether it's allowed, whether it's accepted, whether it's normal, all of these raise halachic issues. And then, of course, we come to Lashon Hara, which is very, very prevalent in the workplace, and I will elaborate on that very, very shortly. Let me briefly, again, it's very, very hard, as I said, to address even a small fraction of all of these issues. But let me briefly indicate four relational contexts that I think are common to virtually all business relationships and discuss some of the issues. We could posit that anyone that is involved in making money owes obligations to four groups in society within the Jewish tradition. One owes their obligations to their competitors, which is an interesting concept of owing an obligation to a competitor. One owes an obligation to their customers or clientele. One owes an obligation to co-workers and employees. And finally, one owes obligations to the legal system and the government. So let's briefly indicate the various types of obligations. And again, I'm speaking very generally here because this can apply whether one is a lawyer, whether one is an accountant, whether one is a journalist, whether one runs a store. Let's take competitors first. If we were to ask, in a capitalist society, what obligations do I owe my competitors? A true free marketer would say, nothing at all. After all, the Adam Smith theory of competition is that kind of a social Darwinian model, that there ought to be survival of the fittest, and competition enhances better prices, greater variety, and therefore if I could make a better mousetrap, as it were, I ought to put you out of business because you don't keep up. Well, we do know in the Jewish tradition there is a notion, at least in going with Nimishu Ephedim, going beyond the letter of the law, that one should regard the right of a competitor to make money. You know the famous story about the Chafetz Chaim, that when the Chafetz Chaim, in his younger years, his wife and himself, they ran a dry goods store in Radom, a small little town in Poland, and because he was so meticulously honest, all of the business was going to him, and they weren't going to the other people in town, and he eventually instructed his Rebbetzin that she should only be open for 1 hour a day to make enough money to live for that day in order that other people should get business. Now what happened was, like the Jimmy Carter gas lines, everybody was lining up to be there for that 1 hour, so eventually he literally put himself out of business not to take money away from his competitors. Now, this is certainly going beyond the letter of the law. Nobody would say that a physician, lawyer, store owner must put themselves out of business in order to give money to other people. But it does exemplify at least an attitude going beyond the law. But there is a Mishnah Bavamatsiya that actually discusses, as a matter of halacha, what my duties are towards my competitors. There's a machlokas that, according to Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, a store owner is not supposed to give kids candy and sweets because that will convince the parents to patronize the store, and that is a form of unfair competition. That is what Rabbi Yehuda says. But the Chachamim disagree. Because the Chachamim say, hey, you give the person candy, let the other person give raisins and fruit. Of course, kids like candy more. But the point is that the Chachamim recognize the ability to engage in competitive behavior, provided, though, and this is where the Rishonim come in, provided there is this concept of equal access and equal opportunity. And from this passage and a few other passages, the medieval authorities, the Rishonim, construct a halachic edifice dealing with the concept of fair competition and unfair competition. And again, it's hard to summarize. Let me just mention a few of the basic parameters. We know that very often a big store, a big chain, can come into a neighborhood, and because they have economies of scale, and because they could sell below cost in one store, because they could simply raise the prices in a more affluent neighborhood, they can actually sell below cost till they drive out the competition. And once the competition is gone, they then have the freedom to raise the prices sky high. Well, the Rishonim already indicates that although if I could manufacture a good at a lower cost and sell it at a lower cost, that is legitimate competition, but to sell below your cost, in other words, to sell at a loss for the purpose of driving out a competitor with the intention of then raising it, is considered to be unfair competition. Now, granted, the chain stores do not call up Rabbanim and ask Shilas before they do this, but theoretically, when there was a Beis Din that had jurisdiction, this type of hafagas kavod, of infringement, might be enjoined. Another example of unfair competition is discriminatory pricing efforts which are specifically directed at a competitor's clientele. Let's assume that one obtains customer lists or the like, and one makes offers not to the general public, but one makes specific offers to the pre-existing customers of a given firm. That might be considered an issue of unfair competition that a Beis Din will be regarded as improper. Often, of course, there are going to be difficult issues as to whom does a client belong? In other words, it's very interesting. Again, in the law firms and in medical practice, you'll have this issue. Let's assume I'm an associate in a law firm. I've been working in a law firm for 6 years, and I have been servicing a lot of clients. I am now planning on going off on my own because I have not been sufficiently recognized in the law firm. I want to start my own practice. Now, it is clear, halakhically, there is no problem in my notifying people that I'm doing so. And if they want to go to me, they can do so. That's not a problem. But the question is, to what extent can I engage in active solicitation to take them away from the firm and go with me? Now, the Rishayim do tell us that to openly solicit people who already have commitment to a pre-existing business may be improper, but you see there's a conceptual difficulty here. Do the clients regard me as their lawyer, or do the clients regard the firm as their lawyer? I mean, now granted, from a legal and business standpoint, they are clients of a law firm, of a partnership of sorts. But as a practical matter, if I'm the person they're doing all the business with, then one could make the argument, even halakhically, that I'm not taking them away from the person that is providing the service. I am the person that's providing the service. The same issue is going to be in medical practice when an associate breaks away to go off on their own. So again, these are issues that need to be discussed, but the Rishonim have indicated that this is a form of unfair competition, to have what is called discriminatory overtures towards pre-existing customers that have made a commitment. Now, in any Jewish community in which you have more than one pizza store or the like, and again, I'm not really familiar with the kosher establishments in Teaneck, but all of you know that when pizza store number two opens up, when there's only a pizza store number one, pizza store number one is normally going to shout something that is called hasagas gavul. You're cutting into my boundary, as it were. And once again, it's very, very complicated, and it's very interesting that hasagas gavul seems to be one of the halachic concepts that depends very much on the assessment and discretion of a Beis Din. For example, many but they did virtually never find hasagas gavul because they argue, I guess you can call them competitive but they did. They argue that if the market is big enough to support two businesses, let the market decide which is better, etc. Other what they did could be described as protectionists, to use kind of antitrust analogies, in which they will kind of create an entitlement for the first business that enters. Generally speaking, the test, according to Rav Moshe, is the market sufficient that all participants are able to make a minimal living from that? Now, Rav Moshe was probably very deliberately vague in articulating that standard, because what exactly is a minimal living? But suffice it to say that Rav Moshe says there is no halachic problem in my opening a business that will divert profit from me, meaning to say, hasagas gavul could result if my opening up a business will put you out of business, but the addition of a competitor in market entry is generally not a grounds for hasagas gavul, unless it falls into the notion of selling at a loss or some discriminatory pricing effort directed at a clientele. Other than that, we would have to say that halacha is actually in favor of competition. But again, the laws of unfair competition are very, very fascinating, and a lot of economic predatory activity would have to be in product discharging. Now, I remember when I was a kid, and I'm sure a lot of you remember this, and you used to see old advertisements on television. You never mentioned the competitor. You know, they would have some detergent, and everything else would be covered in a paper bag, and it would say brand X. Well, there were reasons for that. There were either legal reasons, and also in order not to give any credence to the existence of some alternative brand. Well, today, if you're watching television and you see a Coke commercial or a Pepsi commercial, and you're not paying attention, you know, it's sometimes hard to see. If I see a Coke commercial or a Pepsi, because you see the Coke and the Pepsi and McDonald's and Burger King and everything else. Now, we know that any type of advertising campaign that disparages a competitor, that kind of says this product isn't as good for a variety of reasons, may potentially run afoul of Lashon Hara. Remember, we know that the laws of Lashon Hara, as codified in the Chafetz Chaim's book, we have a whole book on the laws of gossip, were very unique. Somebody once asked the Chafetz Chaim, how could you be so mean to Klal Yisrael to give us a book about all the law, all the things we cannot say? So the Chafetz Chaim's answer is, I did you a big favor. Lashon Hara is an Isser D'Oraisa. If you didn't know the laws, you wouldn't be allowed to say anything, because Safek D'Oraisa L'Chumra, any doubt regarding a Torah law, you got to be strict. You couldn't say a thing, because maybe it's Lashon Hara. So the Chafetz Chaim said, I gave you the means to talk. I didn't give you the means to be quiet. But being as it may, you know the famous story about the Chafetz Chaim, that he was once on a train, and he was still anonymous, then relatively anonymous. He wrote his forum anonymously, and he would go around selling them. And his seatmate on the train said, oh, you're selling the Chafetz Chaim's forum. He must be a wonderful rabbi, a great rabbi, a tzaddik. So the Chafetz Chaim says, I know the guy, he's nobody special. So the man was so incensed at this chutzpah that he slapped the Chafetz Chaim in the face. When they get to the town, in Warsaw, there's a welcoming committee to the Chafetz Chaim. He is known then. And the man says, who is this person you're welcoming? He said, oh, this is the Chafetz Chaim. So the man was, you could imagine, was so humiliated. And he begged the Chafetz Chaim's forgiveness. And the Chafetz Chaim says, you know, you taught me a very important lesson. Just like I don't say Lashon Hara about other people, I shouldn't say Lashon Hara about myself. There's a tremendous insight in there. It's not just a cute story. Because what it tells us is that the psychological need to put others down often comes because we have a poor image of ourselves, meaning we need to pull other people down because of the way we feel about ourselves. If one feels their worthiness, their chashivas, their importance in the eyes of the Ribono Shel Olam, there is less of a need to put down other people. But we know that a lot of advertising campaigns can involve Lashon Hara. Imagine, for example, particularly, I guess, even more than mercantile advertising, imagine political campaigns, where you simply talk about the shortcomings of X, Y, and Z, and we know that Lashon Hara applies even if it's true. Right? If it's not true, it's a much worse avera. Lashon Hara specifically is the disclosure of derogatory information or embarrassing information, even if it's true. Now, once again, the Chafetz Chaim in his book mentions, in fact, he has a whole chapter on what we might call product disparagement. He was not dealing with Madison Avenue. He was dealing with Beryl and Shmerel, where Beryl and Shmerel are two tailors in a small shtetl, and Beryl wants to get your business, and you indicate you're going to buy a suit from Shmerel. What can Beryl tell you about Shmerel's tailoring abilities? And the Chafetz Chaim says that sometimes disclosure is permitted, and not only is disclosure permitted, but disclosure is mandatory. This is why the laws of Hashanah are very hard, because you can't always say, I'm going to play it safe. In other words, sometimes a person might say, you know, if I don't know if something is Lashonara or not, I will be strict and not speak. But you know, that's not a totally satisfactory resolution, because sometimes the laws of Lashonara not only permit you to speak, they require you to speak, right? Because there's a chiyuv of lo samod al dam reyecha, not to stand by idly if somebody's going to suffer, right? But a shidduch is a good example. It's a complicated area. Just to give you a simple example, if I know that a young woman is going to marry a man that has a history of violence, which has not been treated, again, if it's been treated, everything is a question here, but let's take a simple case. It has not been treated and it is ongoing, and he has not disclosed that to her. I have an absolute obligation to inform her of that, and that is the chiyuv d'oraisa of lo samad al dam reyecha, and for a person to say, I'm going to be strict in the laws of Lashon Hara, and not do so would in itself be a great avayer. Now, it's extraordinarily complicated. What if he committed violence 20 years ago and has been in therapy and has medication? Do I have to bring that up? These are shailos, but I'm just giving you an easy case where it's still an ongoing behavior that the person is engaged in. Well, the Chofetz Chaim says, product disparagement can fall within the legitimate parameters of toelos, of helping third persons avert financial loss, if there are a number of conditions that are met. Number one, what you say has to be true. Okay, that's number one. Number two, if your information is secondhand, you've heard about it from somebody, you must report it as secondhand so the veracity of the information can be appropriately discounted. Number three, well, don't exaggerate, so if Schmerl has made two bad suits, don't say everything Schmerl makes is junk. You say there are two bad suits that he made. Then the Chofetz Chaim goes on and says, your kavana must be for the benefit of the third party and not for your self-aggrandizement, which of course makes it very difficult for a competitor to be the one that discloses. Number four, the Chofetz Chaim says, this is very fascinating, there has to be a likelihood that your words will make a difference. Meaning, if your words will dissuade the person from being harmed, then it's a legitimate disclosure. If they're going to go ahead and do it anyway, then it just becomes gossip. Now, that's really fascinating. In a way, this is almost counterintuitive. Because if you were to ask Schmerl, would you rather have me talk about you if he's going to buy your suit anyway? Or would you like me to talk about you if it's going to cost you a sale? Schmerl might say, well, if you're going to talk about me, talk about me to the guy who's going to buy my suit anyway, and not to the guy who's going to cancel. And yet, in the laws of Lashon Hara, it's exactly the opposite, the Chofetz Chaim said. If the heter, or the mitzvah, of disclosure is in order to avert the financial loss, then there has to be at least a substantial likelihood that this will prevent him from incurring the loss, and not to stand be an act of gossip. Based on this, once again, one has to examine advertising campaigns. Certainly, various campaigns, and again, with politics, it's a very delicate issue, and this gets us into the fact, from either in advertising or journalism, in Yana Diyuma, is it legitimate to discuss, let's say, the sex life or the private life of politicians? Or is it pure Lashon Hara? Again, a difficult issue, and the reason it's difficult is the following. On one hand, Lashon Hara says you don't discuss derogatory information about people, even if it's true. Lashon Hara, I'm not addressing the issue of a guy here, that's yet another issue. But let's just look at it in terms of Lashon Hara. On the other hand, Lashon Hara that protects the public, or protects other people from harm, is considered to be legitimate and even mandatory disclosure. Now the question is, certainly, if a politician is taking bribes, if a politician is engaged in dishonest conduct in the government responsibility, that would be a permissible disclosure because the public needs to know that those that they have elected are carrying out their duties or are not carrying out their duties. But the issue then becomes, does private morality have an impact on their ability and their competence and their honesty in carrying out public duties? If one says that it does, then that would be nichlal in the din of Lashon Hara L'Toelah. If one separates the two spheres, then it would just be a matter of gossip. Now, interestingly enough, I have not seen an extensive contemporary discussion of this issue. But I did come across a passage in a Sefer HaYikarim, which goes all the way back, a very famous work on Jewish medieval philosophy by Rav Yosef Alba, that goes back to the 1400s. And Rav Yosef Alba raises the following question in biblical interpretation. How come it is that when Shaul HaMelech sinned in not killing the king of Amalek, he basically lost his job? He was not given a second chance. Shmuel said, "You're fired. This is it." When David HaMelech commits the sin with Bathsheba, whatever the case was, the Gemara says she actually wasn't married, it wasn't adultery, but obviously it was a very, very serious case. And David was punished for that case. David lost a child. David had many, many sufferings because of that case. But Hashem never took the malchus from David. Hashem gave David a second chance. Hashem accepted David's tshuva, and indeed Mashiach will come from David HaMelech. The Sefer HaYikarim says, why is Shaul's sin, which after all is only a sin of omission, so much worse in Hashem's eyes than David's sin, which was a sin of commission involving murder and at least quasi-adultery and the like? So the Sefer HaYikarim gives two answers, both of which are startlingly relevant to the contemporary political situation, although they cut in opposite directions. Answer number one is, it may have been that David's sin is worse than Shaul's sin, but the difference is the responsibility they took when they were confronted with the chait. When Shaul is confronted with his chait, you recall, Shaul's first response is denial. What do you mean? I did everything you wanted. And when Shmuel says, I hear the sheep and I hear etc., so the next, if you can't deny anymore, he blames it. He passes the buck and says, oh, it was the people. When David is confronted with the chait, David says, chatasi, I have sinned. The difference is, leaders can fail, but leaders must acknowledge responsibility and not pass the buck. Again, you can draw your own implications. That is one answer. The second answer, the Sefer HaYikarim gives, is that Shaul sinned in his professional duties as king. The eradication of Amalek was a governmental responsibility. He failed to carry out a duty of government, and that is a grounds for removal. David's failure was a personal moral failing, and a personal moral failing is not a grounds for removal, which is an amazing statement coming from a Jewish makor, where obviously the notion of obedience to the will of God is such a paramount value. But the point I'm making is that if one takes the Sefer HaYikarim's position, that would have Lashon Hara implications as well. If one does accept this to mean that there is a concept of personal private life which does not impact on professional duty, then that would also mean it is no longer a right that the public has to know, and if that is the situation, it would be Lashon Hara. Now again, in our particular case that we face, it's very, very confusing because the private life turns into perjury, obstruction of justice, and other things which then refer to public duties as well. But the point is this: the journalist, the advertising copywriter, whatever it may be, at least has to ask the question. There's an old saying, She'elat chacham chatzi tshuva, the question of a wise person is at least half the answer. If we don't think about this, if we don't ask these questions, then indeed we're never going to be able to come to any type of resolution. So again, the hour is late, let me just read through things fairly quickly. This is really only the first of the four groups that I wanted to talk about, duties towards competitors. And indeed, there is a duty towards competitors. My duties towards my customers and my clientele, I already mentioned, lifne iver lo sitein michshol, do not put a stumbling block in front of a blind person, which means do not give another person injurious or detrimental advice that is to your advantage and not to their advantage. Well, we know this. We go through many, many professions. Medicine sometimes suffers from over-testing, ordering extra tests in order to generate fees, although with HMOs, it's gone in the opposite direction. But historically, there had been this problem of defensive medicine. Churning in the securities industry, where you keep on selling and buying securities, to generate commissions, which are of no particular benefit to the customer. High-pressure promotional sales techniques, such as is employed in life insurance and door-to-door encyclopedias, etc. All of these are a violation of Lifnei-Iver, Madison Avenue advertising, because remember, although it is in our interest to make money, but we cannot do so by offering people advice or counsel or suggestions or recommendations that are injurious to them. Now, Ben Franklin just said that that's just good business anyway, meaning to say one could certainly make the argument that if one makes their money by giving people dumb steers, then obviously eventually it's going to come back to them. And that is true. But from the Jewish perspective, that is also irrelevant, meaning to say whether it's a good business technique or a bad business technique, it is one that you must avoid. And that is, there is an achrayus towards considering the interest of the customer or the client as being paramount and not putting a stumbling block before the blind man. Now, we know that secular law has also responded to the notion of high-pressure salesmanship. We know, for example, that the Federal Trade Commission has the well-known rule that if it's a home solicitation sale, if you're approached to buy something in your home, you're given 72 hours to change your mind on the theory that in the home setting, you're under a lot of pressure. You know, if I'm in a store, I can just walk out if I feel too much pressure. In my home, I don't have that much of a place to go, so I'm given a cooling off period. But still, many, many people feel that once they sign something, they're just embarrassed to cancel. And therefore, you know, the rule is not as effective as it might otherwise be. But they tell the story, Rabbi Yeruchim, great, great Baal Musar in Europe, he was the Mashiach of Mir before World War II, that in Rabbi Yeruchim's youth, he worked for his father-in-law in the summers, when he got shortly after he got married. His father-in-law had a restaurant in Poland. And Rabbi Yeruchim was a waiter in the restaurant, a Ben Asmanim in Yeshiva. And whenever a customer would come in and order something, Rabbi Yeruchim would give him all the reasons why he shouldn't really get it. Because chicken, I don't know what the variety is, probably didn't have falafel in Poland. But whatever, the person orders chicken, he'd say, well, the chicken's a little stale today, not so good, you don't want to have that. So anyway, at the end of the summer, it worked out well for Rabbi Yeruchim. His father-in-law said, you know, I'm going to support you in Kollel for a while, because you may not be cut out for this type of thing. And even today, if you go to certain places, I think it's places in Yerushalayim, you walk into certain stores, and it's almost as if the merchant does not want to sell you anything. Number one, they might be sitting and learning, and they're almost kind of annoyed that you're interrupting them. And number two, there are erlicha people who will actually say, you know, this thing is damaged. Did you notice this? Did you notice that? Did you see this? You can get something cheaper a few miles away. The sense of trying to point out every possible chisara in order that you shouldn't be deceived or cheated. And I should emphasize, too, that this isn't only a question of Lifnei-Iver, this is also the principle of Geneva Staff. And this is something in which modern law has only caught up relatively recently. And that is, the traditional common law rule was always, in terms of disclosing defects and problems, a rule that is called caveat emptor, let the buyer beware, meaning the common law prohibited fraud. I couldn't lie to you, but I didn't have to disclose any particular problem. There's a famous case in Massachusetts, I remember teaching a contracts class, of somebody who bought a house that was not inspected for termites. You know, today it would be standard, but it wasn't inspected. And 2 days after closing, the entire house collapsed. And the person brought a lawsuit to get his money back. And the court said, well, he didn't tell you there were no termites, did he? He didn't lie. He just didn't tell you. And that's the classic statement of the traditional rule of caveat emptor, in which as long as you don't lie, there is no affirmative duty of disclosure, absent a special relationship, on some level. Well, modern law has moved away from this in many areas, not in all areas, with a concept called implied warranty. So, for example, in a contract for the sale of a car, even if I didn't say there are no brakes, as it were, there's an implied representation that it is fit for its ordinary purposes, right? So there's a notion that if there's a problem, you got to disclose it, and in the absence of that disclosure, it'll be presumed it's okay. But it should be noted that according to Jewish law, going back to Chazal, going back to the Gemara, the notion of Geneva Stas was never limited to affirmative misrepresentation, but it did impose an actual duty of disclosure of any problem that you are aware of, that you must call it to the buyer's attention, unless it is such an obvious problem that the buyer could see it for himself. So if I'm selling you a car and the front headlight is smashed, I don't have to tell the buyer, did you see that, unless the buyer is blind, I don't have to tell the buyer, did you see the front headlight? I don't have to, you know, make a point of that, although many righteous people do. On the other hand, if there's a problem with the transmission or the brakes that would not be immediately apparent, there is a chiyuv to inform the buyer, because otherwise that is treated as geneva stah. I should emphasize that at least in terms of the halacha of the Beis Din, this is not merely a moral duty, this is a legal duty, in the sense that if a buyer discovers defects of which he was not aware, the buyer has the right to cancel the sale and get a full refund of the purchase price, because that is the principle of mekach tov. And in fact, that doesn't only apply if the seller was aware of the problem, but even if the seller was not aware of the problem, the buyer may still have a restitutionary right to cancel. So once again, this deals with the obligations of disclosure that are indeed much more severe, much greater than they might be under many aspects of secular. Again, there are other things too. I'll have to be short. My third group, my duties towards my employers and my coworkers. Here, of course, the ideas of mussar, respect, dignity, kiddush Hashem, are of paramount importance. How do we talk to our secretaries, our receptionists, the janitorial staff? Remember, particularly if we work in non-Jewish environments, we are taken as the representatives of Klal Yisrael. The way we behave, not enough to say, Chaim once told somebody that he shouldn't behave this way because it's not fitting for a Talmud Chacham. So the person protested, I'm not a Talmud Chacham, just a regular person. So he said, for purposes of Chilul Hashem, you're enough of a Talmud Chacham. Meaning to say that, you know, we might say, who are we to be considered the representatives of the Jewish people? But indeed, out there in the world, we are. And we have to be very, very cognizant of the notions of Chilul Hashem and Kiddush Hashem, which are so prevalent. And this manifests itself even in the small ways. The derech eretz, the politeness, the not screaming, not yelling, not abusing people, which often in the pressures of the workplace becomes inevitable. And, you know, that's certainly something that all of us have to be aware of. I think that the government and legal system, I did discuss primarily the requirement of obeying secular law in matters of tax, dina de malchus adina, and the prohibition against litigation I alluded to much earlier. Again, I do have to rush here, but let me just take another 5 minutes just to conclude. And that is, the Chassam Sofer was once asked, why is it that when a butcher brings his cow to the Beis Din, and the Beis Din paskens it straight, the butcher is perfectly willing to throw away the cow. And yet when Reuven and Shimon go to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din orders Reuven to pay Shimon, why is Reuven going to be so upset? And the Chassam Sofer answered, because when the cow is straight, nobody gets it. So I'm willing to have nobody get it. But when Shimon has to get it, and I have to give it to him, that's something that gets me very upset. But of course, if you think about it, if one truly views the notion of Kol Yisrael as a Guf Echad, all of the Jews are one, in a way it's even better, because when Reuven gives it to Shimon, it's just going from one hand to the other, as opposed to the cow being wasted. We know that the notions of unity, Avas Yisrael, caring about each other, brings us closer to this final redemption. We know that during this time of Sfirat HaOmer, in which we observe many mourning restrictions, we know that this is because of the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva who died because they did not show proper kavod for each other. And we mourn during this period not to be sad, but we mourn to learn and internalize in our own personalities the concept of how important it is to have kavod for each other. And part of that aspect of kavod is behaving with menschlichkeit, with honesty, with integrity, in our dealings with our fellow Jews, and indeed with all human beings who are made the Tzelem Elokim. We are told that the order of Nezikin in the Gemara, which deals with civil law, is called the order of Yeshuos, the order of salvation, because it is that type of attitude that ultimately brings salvation and Geula into the world. Let me end with a word from the Tzadok HaKohen, one of the great Hasidic rabbis of the last century, the very beginning of this century, where he quotes out that when Hashem gave the Aseret HaDibros, he describes the Aseret HaDibros as being given with thunder and lightning. Thunder and lightning. And then Hashem gives the Eskolos HaBrachot. And then the Aseret HaDibros are given. And right after the Aseret HaDibros, it repeats the same scene, kolos, etc., but there's a little tiny deviation. Instead of saying kolos ubrakim, it says kolos velapidim, thunder and torches. Why the shift from lightning flashes to torches? Most of us wouldn't notice that, but what's the difference? Rav Tzadok points out that what the Torah is trying to teach us here is that the difference in their visualization, they visualize lightning flashes, and then they saw a torch, signifies a spiritual transformation pre-Matan Torah to after Matan Torah. Before the Torah was given, even before the Torah was given, human beings had a desire to live a holy life. That holiness could exist only by disengagement from the world, only by separation, only by rejection. The holy person took a vow of chastity, a vow of poverty, a vow of renunciation. Rav Tzadok suggests that is analogous to lightning. What is lightning? Brilliant flashes of light, but then you're plunged into total darkness. When holiness is defined as disengagement, by definition it cannot last. By definition, you're going to have to eat, you're going to have to sleep, you're going to have to come down from the mountain, you're going to have to go to town sometimes. And therefore there's no way to sustain it. Matan Torah taught us an important lesson. Matan Torah taught us that we can live holy lives not by disengaging from reality, but by confronting that reality and elevating it. But Tzadok suggests that is, in a way, a tragic compromise, because that's like a torch. A torch is not as bright as lightning. It's not as flashy as lightning. It flickers. It's not as powerful. But it endures. It gives you warmth. It gives you direction. If you have to navigate a tortuous road, you cannot do so with a lightning flash, because one second you have it, but then you have to make a turn and maybe you'll fall off. But lightning, but the torch gives you the guidance, gives you the warmth. And therefore, Matan Torah taught the Jewish people how to live in the world with holiness and with goodness. And this, as I said before, is the nisayon of living in the business world. Again, I hope you have some time for some questions and other points of discussion. And in this way, if we can make the transformation from the holiness of the lightning flash to the holiness of the torch, we have achieved what Matan Torah is designed to teach us. Thank you very much for this. Any questions?